Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank, which this week is holding a series of exceptional live recording sessions to cover our analysis of the economic consequences of the war in Ukraine as it is unfolding. This episode is also part of our Zhongguan Mundus series, our monthly newsletter about global China as seen from Europe. The link to subscribe is going to be in the show notes. I'm here with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero, joining us from Taipei. Hi, Alicia. How are you?
All fine, thank you.
And I'm happy to have with us also Elina Rybakova, who is deputy chief economist at the Institute of International Finance, based in Washington, D.C. Hi, Elina. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Giuseppe. Hi, Alicia.
In this episode, we want to understand better the dynamics at play between Russia and China. I would like to remind you also that you can ask questions during this live recording session by connecting to Slido, sli.do, and typing there the hashtag China. So, back and starting about the topic. In the past few days, we are seeing a fast-moving situation on the front of the war, of course, but also on the front of the relations between Beijing and Moscow, with many question marks about shifting tones in Beijing related to the conflict, but which can still be inscribed within an ambiguous neutrality stance from the China side. On one hand, avoiding to ditch the partnership with the Kremlin. On the other hand, in line with such difficult balancing act, the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has publicly stated that all countries' sovereignty and territorial integrity should be protected, including Ukraine's. Can we recap what is the situation at the moment? What is going on between China and Russia right now? Elina, maybe you can help our listeners and ourselves to understand better.
Thank you so much, Giuseppe. But I'll start also with the recap, what's happening in Russia, and then pass on the baton a bit with the link of China-Russia to China. So in terms of the situation in Russia, I think it is critical to understand that the sanctions are hard-hitting. And given the situation in Ukraine, we can expect potentially further tightening of the sanctions. So that is key. And we're in the new reality where there is war in Ukraine, and at the same time, there is war by other means, sanctions, with Russia. And we saw that development starting from the early announcement by the Central Bank of Russia and other authorities on Monday. I think they're still trying to treat it as a more technocratic balance of payments crisis. But I think as the situation evolves, they will go more into the war mentality. And I think the measures that would seem to be as inconceivable just a few days ago, I think we'll also start seeing them on the Russia side. Central Bank of Russia lost access to 40, potentially half of their reserves of 640 billion. So they have access to only about half of it, maybe a bit more. 20% of all reserves are in gold. So it's difficult for them to do interventions. And it's possible there will be further tightening of measures to access foreign exchange. So therefore, in that respect, it will be critical for them to have access to renminbi. They have investments in renminbi, also potentially support from Chinese authorities in intervention or Chinese banks. Since many domestic Russian banks are now disconnected from SWIFT, and those who are not disconnected are probably struggling because of overcompliance. Most banks have stepped away from working in Russia, and even companies for political reasons are also stepping away. So again, for them, it will be critical to have the access to the other payment systems and payments messaging systems, potentially the one in China. Domestically, Russia can process via the domestic systems that they started since the sanctions, the Russian domestic payments and messaging system, about 20%. They will have to do 100%. And then for the external links, they will be looking for guidance. As you pointed out correctly, China till recently had a neutral stance. China is also very important importer of Russian commodities, a range of commodities. Of course, physically, it's very hard for Russia to divert all of its gas bulk of its gas from Europe to China just because there isn't infrastructure. But the link is there if it's deeper. It's not just gas that China imports from Russia. So with that, I'll pass it on back to you, Giuseppe.
Thank you, Elena. I would like to see from Alicia, seen from the other side of the world, how the situation, the current situation, is being perceived, or the current position of China is being told in that part of the world.
Well, exactly, because we are at the other side of the world, things look pretty different. So we, you know, and the China Daily, I think last Friday, so a week ago, would, you know, open with this idea of Russia steps up to stop the militarization of Ukraine. So that's kind of the message that still remains. I mean, there's not yet a recognition of invasion. There's not yet, especially in the domestic sphere. So that's where we are. But that in a way, you know, because China has been really pretty insulated from Western media for reasons we all understand. And of course, the internet is something that we've been seeing in China for a long time. And I would not argue that this is specific to this event, but rather a more general. So from that perspective, and I think it's important to understand from that perspective, where are we? Because, you know, the conflict is becoming much wider, yeah, and the EU is increasingly involved and so on. Well, two things to note. First of all, China has become an increasingly important trading partner for Russia, and Elena knows very well, but even so, it's about, yes, the largest trading partner, just because people don't understand that the EU is actually a single trading partner as far as we're concerned, because this competence has been centralized a while ago. So if we actually think of Europe as a trading partner, Europe is actually double. You know, it's like 18 as opposed to 32 or something like that. So basically, it's much bigger still today. And by the way, those shares, and we wrote a piece for Bruegel a long time ago, indeed have been, you know, reducing for Europe. It was much bigger before, I think all the way to 50, and then China going up. So that's the trend, but we're not yet there. It's kind of coming too early. If you think about that substitution, that's on trade. And as Elena said, for gas, it's very obvious. There's no connection with the Power of Siberia gas pipeline and, you know, the West pipelines yet, although this was one of the key agreements reached on February 4th between Xi Jinping and Putin, which was to build this Power of Siberia too, which was indeed to make that connection possible, thus a much faster kind of shift towards Asia, China, but I mean, I think what Putin had in mind with its pivot to Asia was not only China, but it so happens that it ended up being mainly China. But the point is eastwards, and that's not ready yet. So I don't think we are there. On the payment systems, Elena also mentioned, I'll be very brief, we're not there either, because CIPS is first very small. It has about 70 non-Chinese financial institutions hooked to CIPS, plus it still runs on SWIFT. I mean, we could go on and on and on. It's not yet a substitute for, but as Elena said, there is what I call the direct channels, the PBOC. The PBOC has what, Elena, you know, like about 90 billion equivalent, US dollar equivalent in renminbi reserves from Russia. So the question is, are they ready to convert to dollar? Because that's not going to make it, you know. The renminbi is going to be used for what? Imports? For how long in Vietnam? I mean, my calculations is with this share, it would be about a year. But if you have to double the share because you cannot access European imports, it's going to be 6 months at most. And you cannot run out of renminbi, you would have to. So my point is that in a nutshell, this idea that China can do it all in this particular case, at this particular time, is a little bit of an exaggeration, I would argue.
So basically, if I understand correctly, you are saying, Alicia, that on the trade side, seen from China, Russia is an important trade partner, but is definitely not the single trade partner that makes the overall difference. Maybe we can ask Elina how it can be from the other side, from the Russian side, because what is the impact for Russia? Or, I mean, how Russia sees China, that's the other part of the story. But then the other thing which is very interesting you're saying, Alicia, is that basically the idea that Russia could circumvent the sanctions via China, you know, in one way or another, circumventing the ban of certain banks on SWIFT and starting to use the Chinese system of payments and the other things you mentioned, basically there is not enough scale over there to make China the reason why Russia would not care about the sanctions, basically. If I'm putting it in other words. So maybe we can stay a little bit more on the economic side. Indeed, Elina, maybe you can help us to, in a reverse fashion from what Alicia has been telling us, how do you think Russia is seeing the economic effect, you know, of the relations with China in this very moment? Let's keep let's pause for a while afterwards, and we go back to the history of the relations and so on, because that will be a very important thing to put into perspective. But you know, still on the analysis of what's going on there.
Thank you. So for Russia, China is an important country to cooperate with. You know, it is the largest source of imports for Russia comes from China. It's almost 25%, it's 23%. So they import the most from China and then followed by European countries. In terms of exports, also China accounts for almost 15% of Russia's exports. It's mostly commodities, of course. So for Russia overall, as a trading partner, China is extremely important, if not one of the most important countries that they're working with. In terms of the overall trade currency for trade, still, you know, it's euro, it's a bit of ruble, but, you know, dollar, these are the key currencies. Even with China, the trade doesn't happen in renminbi or rubles. There is some, but it's still very small. So for Russia overall, rubles account for, I think, like 12-15% of total trade. It's not with China, it's with some of the other republics that Russia is trading with. And of course, dollar is still the most important one with 55%. And including with China. So for Russia, this is the trade relationship. But I have to say, this week, today, for Russia, it's most important what to do with the central bank. You know, trade is almost secondary at the moment. I'm sure we'll come to think about that once we start discussing trade embargoes and sanctions. And I am afraid we're going to come. It's very likely we're going to come to that. But as of now, Russian central bank is fantastically trained, wonderful experience, but they have found themselves in a new reality of war. And I think it's still taking them time to readjust. They started with technocratic measures. They moved their rate. They more than doubled the rate to 20%. The interbank market is still coming to 28. They were forced to keep the Moscow exchange closed most of this week. They've been closing it. Externally, equities can no longer be traded on the London exchange, for example. They're increasingly putting in capital controls. So just very quickly on the capital controls, 80% of exports have to be surrendered. Then you also have a potentially 30% charge on conversion. And then you're also no longer honoring foreigners' requests for equities or fixed income in order for it to repay. Also, there is talk of not repaying FX-denominated debt, potentially new debt, but I think we're going to move to total debt. And one of the comments from the authorities was that we're not going to allow foreign companies to divest from Russia, period. So, and this is, we are, what, Wednesday? So I think Russian Central Bank and authorities really at this stage need somebody outside, and they're looking to China to help them with the interventions on the market. We have about 21% of household deposits on foreign exchange, non-ruble, so it can be euro, dollar, anything. It's about 200 billion rubles. So this reserves the half of 640, let's say, you know, 300 and something, 400 maybe. There are a lot of demands on it already. You know, if they don't manage to stop conversion and they really don't want to go towards freezing of foreign exchange deposits of individuals, they need to find a way to intervene in the market constructively. And I think this is the first call of business with China, with the central bank.
And Alicia, I don't know if you have any element to reply to Elena in this regard. Do you think China is going to do any of those things that Russia expects?
Well, at a high price. Well, there are already some little presence in the English cooperation signed on February 4th, I believe. One was Arctic cooperation, which I'm sure Russia had to give up, or you know, like in exchange for support. What kind of support? We can't really know. But you know, maybe Elena is right. The support could have perhaps been all the way to very specific financial support of beyond. Here, I mean, give me my reserves, because the only thing that is clear is that equivalent of 90 billion, though in renminbi, belongs to the Central Bank of Russia. I mean, that's no doubt. I mean, but beyond that, the conversion, or what Elena is saying, which is very interesting, forex intervention on behalf of CBR, based on what I've seen in the market of the reaction of by the way, state-owned commercial banks, meaning nobody was their own decision, to be frank, which is basically, I'm not even accepting letter of credits for oil and gas, which is not even sanctioned. You know, I'm just saying, Elena's expectation, I understand. Maybe there is a master agreement out there that the PBOC will do forex intervention on behalf of the CBR. But what I see in the market is that banks, including, again, state-owned banks, are saying, I am not touching that. That's what we are now. So the jump has to be pretty intense. Yeah. And my question for Elena, who knows it all on this one, is that legal? That's my question. Meaning, I don't know. I'm just saying, can't the PBOC lightly, without any risk, intervene in the forest market to support, because the idea is that it would use its own reserves to support the ruble, correct? I mean, that's what we're talking about. But I don't think they can do that with renminbi, can they? They will have to use their own reserves, dollar reserves, to do that, yeah? So wouldn't it be easier to allow the conversion of those 90 billion in reserves, or the swap line that the PBOC has with the CBR, the Central Bank of Russia, to push the risk on their side? Because, you know, you see what I mean? Like, I'm not sure whether they can actually, without the interpretation of sanctions, I wonder, could it be extended to not being allowed to do that? Would it be too much of an interference? How would that be read? The minute, if I were an analyst and I happen to be in a bank somewhere, I would be writing, wow, the PBOC is using its balance sheet to support the ruble. I mean, it's not a minor thing to do. So Elena, my point is, how would you see that happening? Yeah, and the risk for the PBOC.
I think there are important risks, because the U.S. itself, as we know very well, has been very aggressive in terms of extraterritoriality application of their sanctions. And you have the primary sanctions, then you can also do secondary sanctions, which means on foreign entities and foreign operations. And you can do also application of primary sanctions extraterritoriality. So if somebody who is linked to sanctioning activity, you can still try to go after them. And the U.S. has been very aggressive with that. In fact, until recently, it was European partners. There was a big point of confrontation, including about Iran, that we wrote about still in Bruegel. So U.S. can be very forceful with the application. And China, as we know, after Hong Kong, there were concerns about also sanctioning China at some point. So that is not entirely off the table. So I think the US and Europe will be watching very closely what China does and trying to see how they can link them in via this sort of extraterritorial application of sanctions. If you do any transactions with dollars, you know, eventually it goes back to a US jurisdiction. And for example, no international bank can possibly work with the banks on SDN list, and Central Bank is not on the SDN list. But if you are on SDN list, if you're found to work with them and you have you won't eventually have access to the US dollar, it's unlikely, it's likely they will trace you and they will can go after you. With the central bank now, I think the thinking, it's very new. It's the central bank is not on SDN list. It's somewhat different way of sanctioning. So we are finding out as we go along, because Russia also has issues with BIS in theory, you know, should it's sort of a different legal entity. For example, or the IMF, the SDRs at the IMF, it's also very different legal entities, but respectively, they are in the US and in Switzerland. And Switzerland says it's going to be complying with the sanctions. So what does it mean for the either IMF or BIS? In theory, they have protection of the reserves there, but you know, we are in this new world. So yes, it's, I think China and especially Chinese banks, of course, going after PBOC with sanctions, that would be extreme. But Chinese banks, I think the US will definitely, and Europe will try to look for ways to do so. That said, US has much more experience about extraterritoriality of application of sanctions than Europe. I find it hard to find the cases of, and Alisa probably also knows that where Europe would do that. And if you look at the European Commission statements, they say that at the time, with respect to the US, we find extraterritorial application of sanctions against our values, against our, you know, we find it sort of illegal, we want to fight it. So if they were to do the same, I think that would be a bit tricky.
All these posits that the Chinese banks might try to help the Russian financial system. But as we have seen also in my introduction, the situation is much more ambiguous than that, if I understand correctly. So here is where politics comes into place. And I have to say that I have several questions from the audience around that question, of course, which is this ambiguity, how it's going to play out in the next hours or days, on one direction or the other direction, because it seems that it could go both ways at the moment. And from what you are saying, at least maybe I'm extrapolating too much, but from what you are saying, it might not be too much in the interest of Chinese banks or of the Chinese economic system to go against the sanctions and trying to shield their own companies and banks from being affected from that, if I am analyzing this correctly, or like paraphrasing a little bit what you're saying for our listeners. Would you confirm that the direction of travel could also go on a neutrality which is a bit more compliant to the international reactions? Or do you think that signals are over there that this ambiguity will not be resolved as such? I don't know whom would like to reply to this. Basically, the question is, what China is going to do?
Okay, let me start. And then Elina, because I know Elina is tired from her trip, so I'm going to give her a respite. And that's what China can give to Russia, by the way, a respite. That's not a solution. It's a respite. And for a respite, you can do it in a way that you still comply with sanctions, at least so far. So that's the answer. The answer is the letter of the law and the meaning of the law. So to me, and this we've seen this with Iran, frankly, we probably have seen it with North Korea. It's just that it's hard to track, but otherwise North Korea wouldn't be there, would it? So, I mean, economically speaking, and I don't mean that negatively, because everybody has the right to be there. So, you know, let's face it. I mean, sanctions are not something that I would die for. The point is, where are we now and why do we need them? But so the letter of the law is that, in my view, Chinese banks will make it very clear that they're complying with sanctions because it's in their interest. But at the same time, it is in China's interest, let alone Russia, but certainly China, to offer a helping hand, because Russia is a critically important country for China, let alone they share probably the longest border on Earth. I mean, so, you know, and a lot of issues on that border, by the way, in the past. So why would you get in, why would you want to have a neighbor in deep trouble, number one? Why would you not benefit from offering a helping hand if you've done that, even again, without a neighboring, even if not neighboring Iran, given the resources and you know, So there's ways. We know there are ways. The point is you don't want to do it in the spotlight, and you don't want to do it in a way that you risk being sanctioned, because you've already been sanctioned. As Alina said, we have, you know, all kinds of entity lists, military-related companies on the financial side. We have all kinds of sanctions already. Maybe they're minor and they're not affecting the Chinese economy, but they're certainly not helping in terms of image and beyond. So I think that's the parallel road. But politically, how do you do that? So, of course, playing an intermediary role is a way, but I frankly doubt that Ukraine will be, Zelensky will be jumping on it, because at the end of the day, you need to make sure that an intermediary is indeed neutral. And it's not about Russia, it's about Taiwan. That's the problem, that we have another little thing out there where I'm happy to sit now, that is essential for that intermediary role, because you want to set a precedent that is not only for this conflict, that is for something else. So that's why, as I always say, in the last week, China is in a bind, because it has too many objectives and too many constraints, and some of them do not even relate to this conflict. So it is a very difficult position. Thus, I think the tone, and I finish here, always observe. Not because they want to be, it's they frankly don't have a choice, because there's too many things happening for them at the same time. And that's the best they can do, basically unconstructive ambiguity, because that's the solution for all of these contradictions. Mao Tun, as they say, you know, the Chinese, is like, I've never seen so many contradictions in foreign policy. Why? Because they can't do otherwise. Not that they don't know how to do otherwise, it's that they can't do otherwise. Yeah.
Alicia, and this brings me to my other question before we go to some more inputs from our audience, which is, let's step 1 second back, and let's try to understand a bit better. You mentioned it yourself in your reply, the strategic importance of Russia for China, but I think that this is the time for understanding a bit more the broader aspects of China-Russia relation and how they have been evolved in the past years. I would say, and here I ask especially to Elina, if we can recap a bit, where do we stand? I mean, where are we standing on the 4th of February when there was this joint declaration between Xi and Putin about this partnership without limits or something like that? There was like a very, an important phrasing of this, which now, in the light of what happened in the past few weeks, some commentators are even arguing that maybe Xi has been fooled by Putin on that. But before going on this, like, what has been going on between China and Russia in the past decade, at least?
Thank you so much. The relationship has been very difficult historically. We can go back to Soviet times, and I think that's where but even before, I think, you know, after Russia sort of helped with Manchuria, I think after that it's all got very difficult. And of course, since reopening, if you look at the simple gravity models, and we economists then like to do gravity models for FDI, for trade, it has been much lower than any model would have predicted. And this is because Russia sees oftentimes that it gets the short end of the stick when it has a deal with China. It sees itself as a junior partner relative to China. And now it's in a much weaker position. So for Russian authorities, it's not an obvious choice. Definitely, the dance started more actively after 2014. But even then, we haven't seen much progress. We haven't seen big commitments from China for investments. When in previous crisis, 2008, we tried to do a deal on Gazprom. It's sort of, there was a feeling that we, you know, Russia didn't get the right deal on the commodities either. So it is a difficult relationship. And especially now, coming with a hand stretched out to China, it is difficult. It's not straightforward. There are regions in Far East for Russia, of course, where people speak Chinese as well as they do Russian. There are concerns of being overrun by China economically and also sort of politically. So it's not. I do not see how they can dance easily now. And let's not forget that the next stage of sanctions are very likely to be on trade. And limitations on SWIFT are already type of sort of financial sanctions. It turned out to be also trade sanctions, the way they designed. Not always by design, but basically everybody realized that that's what's happening. And de facto, the US and Europe are happy with that. If the hostilities, if the war in Ukraine continues, we could see also further limitations on commodities. So that's where it might get a little bit interesting for China, whether they would like to do some sort of trade deals with Russia. So that's where we are on the Russian side.
Thank you, Elena, for this recap. And Alicia, do you want to add something else on this more historical perspective to have a little bit of context? And then really there should be some time for questions from the audience, because I'm getting flooded.
Yes, a minute. I absolutely agree with Elena that this is a complex relation. And I would only add that clearly, with this pivot to Asia, which was announced, I think, right after Crimea, sometime end of 2014, I believe, there is a conscious choice that's the exit to what was happening west from Moscow. Yeah, I mean, and this increase in partnership, by the way, which was also accompanied by this major project, this humongous gas pipeline, which I mentioned before, which is now the key Russian export into China. And that was accompanied apparently by a contract of $400 billion in kind of structural gas exports, so that China could feel secure strategically, energy-wise, or at least gas-wise. And I think that's very important. At that time, when this pipeline was finished in 2019, China decided to elevate the relation with Russia to a strategic partner. Only one country in the world has a better official relation with China, which is Pakistan, started much earlier. So there's this ranking of, you see, Russia is very important officially. And finally, beyond that, February, I mean, during the Olympics, this big endless cooperation, which I think that could be a historical event, depending on what happens now in terms of China's reaction to the Ukraine conflict. Yeah, it could literally be one that you read in history books, depending on ultimate reaction long term on Russia's situation. So I just wanted to clarify.
Thanks. And on this, I would like to start taking some questions. I have a question from Nico Keppens, who is asking, will China be the third dog getting the bone the two others were fighting for and did destroy one another? Putting in another way, another question from an anonymous, saying West is spending more on defense and humanitarian aid while China gains from increased trade with Russia. Will China be the real victor of this war?
Maybe I just start quickly. I don't see any real victors from this war, to be honest. It is bad. It's going to get worse. And as Alicia explained, China is watching this potentially with horror as much as everybody else, and trying to do this foreign policy dance that has become much more complicated than when they were signing this agreement for cooperation. So it's we know that sanctions, for example, on oil from Iran gave some waivers if the imports from Iran would come down over 6 months. So this is something that, so if we go towards trade sanctions, and I would not be surprised we do, in fact, we might be more surprised at how soon we do go there. And maybe we start with oil and other commodities, not gas. We don't have to start with gas. Then, yes, China and other countries in India could benefit briefly. But again, I think the choice ultimately in case of Iran was made. People went away from Iran and moved on. So I think with an open war conflict in Europe, I think globally countries will be very careful. It's doubtful we'll have clear winners from this conflict.
Thank you, Elena. I have another question, which is very much voted on the Slido page. Is China really supportive of Russia in the end of the day, or is it just trying to annoy the West and the US in particular? What is happening behind the scene?
Well, maybe I take this one quickly. Yes. I mean, of course, it all depends on what you mean by supporting. Yeah. I mean, how much can China do without hurting itself? That's, I think, the level of support you can imagine China can offer. Because China is not in the best of circumstances, yeah, where the economy has been decelerating very rapidly. We have the two sessions starting this weekend, which is basically this Lianghui, this meeting where they discuss the economic prospects for the year, and they need to possibly announce a growth target. And with this uncertainty, maybe they will avoid it as they did during COVID. But my point is, China is not like jumping around and, you know, in the best. I mean, this is not 2010 at all. So what they can do, I think, is relevant, but not enormous for Russia. And still, however, this brings me, you know, to the Korean War. I mean, whatever they do will be highly appreciated because nobody else is doing anything. So what you need to do doesn't have to be it all for it to be extremely important for Russia. So that's the leverage that China has, that a little could be a lot. And that's, I think, the deal here. So we may think that everything they do is just to, as you said, to insult or to, I mean, not insult, but, you know, to create trouble with the West. But at the end of the day, even very little could be a lot for Russia. So to me, there is support, just the fact they lifted import controls on wheat and other cereal is already a message. So yes, in my view, they're doing what they can. They will not do what they can't, because that's too costly for China. I think that's where we are.
Thank you, Alicia. And speaking about agriculture, I have a question exactly on that. And a question about if China is able and willing to export more agricultural food to Russia as EU agri-food exports are disrupted. And the issue of agriculture between Russia and China is pretty a big one when it comes to the relations between the two countries.
I think the issue of agriculture at the moment is very big for the world, also because of Ukraine. So Ukraine is one of the largest producers from the region. It's even more significant exporter than Russia. And so also is exported to countries that might have difficulties, but well, they're already having difficulties like Egypt or Lebanon or Tunisia. So that is potentially another explosive transmission. Ukraine is very important for China, I understand, in defense sectors and potentially others where they have a relationship. So on food, China here has a relationship with Russia, but also with Ukraine. It will be challenging. And there was a global crisis coming up. Yes, I think this is one of the products that are the least likely to be on any sanctioned list and most likely will continue to be supplied. And here it's something that without being afraid of sanctions, China could potentially benefit. I'll pass on to Alicia maybe if she has more to add.
Alicia, do you want to add something on this?
No, I think it's perfect answer. Not much to. I mean, yes, of course. I mean, and I think that China will provide, in all sense, humanitarian. I mean, food and so on. That's the must and is well understood. And I think we should. I mean, that. To be frank, I don't know why the Russian population has to pay such a high price for. I mean, I understand what we're doing, but on the other hand, I think, you know, Russians are not Putin by all means and purposes. So I understand China having the leeway to do that, and I'm happy they will, because otherwise this would be extremely costly for the Russian population. So I see no. I don't think that's the issue, to be frank. I think the issue really is, can Russia use China to reduce so much the cost of sanctions that they don't matter? That's there is no pressure on Putin. I think that's the question here. But if China uses its leeway to help Russians, frankly speaking,
I think this is the question from the beginning, right, Alicia? It's like from the beginning, what you were trying to present is like a situation where does on the side of Russia, does the weight of China be enough for I would say, not nullify, but at least counterbalance the sanctions. And it seems from the first analysis that you both provided that actually this might not be the case, neither on the financial market side, neither on the trade side. And then the other question is there enough interest from China to go full scale in support Russia? And as you are replying to the questions from the audience, it seems they might be able to go as far as it's not going to harm them. And this red line might be crossed. The threshold of this red line seems to be very, very low. You know, like it's very easily crossed in the current situation. So China might keep this very ambiguous role at the moment. Of course, we are not substituting ourselves to news outlets, so we will keep observing the situation as it unfolds on the news for that regard. Maybe a last question, because we are soon going to run out of time, but Alicia, you mentioned it in one of the replies at some point. Obviously, we cannot close this conversation without even mentioning Taiwan and understanding now more from the military side of the operations in terms of the stance of China. Of course, many analysts have been mentioning that whatever is happening now, China is observing, and that there has and might have a repercussion on the situation between China and Taiwan. You are in Taiwan at the moment, Alicia. So maybe I start with you for that one, and provide us the view that is perceived by you and by the people around you over there.
Okay, this is extremely complex. At first sight, one could argue that what we are seeing should increase the cost of action, and by action I mean forceful action. Maybe I shouldn't say military, because it could come in many ways. It could be cyber attacks, it could be blockade, it could be isolation, but forceful action, because that forceful action will be understood and read faster than before, because we are now ready. You know, like I think that's the silver lining, is that this should, rationally speaking, this should reduce the chances of anything happening in Taiwan anytime soon. But of course, if Putin had been successful in 2 days, we may have a different conversation. But we're not there yet. And I'm under the control of Elena. I don't think the West will, because this, say, ends this weekend, will lift the sanctions, would it? So in a way, it doesn't really matter anymore, because we are already in this conundrum of sanctions, which will last as long as we can imagine, no matter, unless Putin makes a signal, which would still discourage China, because that signal would go against, you know, the idea of a non-costly solution. That's what we are. However, and this is the end of a long story, imagine that the reading of the leadership in China is that, wow, the window of opportunity is shrinking. And actually, to the point of saying that time is not going to go in our favor, because this is a structural change in the global economy. The West has woken up, and there's no way that. Then what is the best time? When the noise is highest, you know, which is now. So I think 90%, I would say it lowers the probability, but there's that 10%, that tail risk, which is what's the actual interpretation of the time left? Because I want to remind the audience that Xi Jinping in the run-up to this new reappointment, let's call it this way, in November, during the discussion of the five-year plan last year, reminded everybody that that was really, if not his key objective and main reason why he would have to stay longer. So, you know, this has to happen sometime, and we don't have the whole, you know, history of the mainland to do this. There is a finite time, and it can't be very long. So people would say 2028, you name it. But this may change the calculation. So that's why I think there is a risk, although small risk, compared to the lower risk that I think is the most obvious outcome. But we're not fully out of the woods, in my opinion.
Thank you, Alicia. Elina, do you want to add anything on this?
Thank you. I think given the sort of this, I think it's important to put it in context. So we in Ukraine, everybody's concerned about Moldova. People are concerned about the Baltics. And also Peskov, press secretary of Putin, made comments that the gossips that they will announce a general draft on March 8th are fake. So they're giving specific date and that's fake. And also there are gossips that, you know, they might have a sense of emergency on March 4th is also fake. So I think that's important to watch that Russia, there is a war on Ukraine, a physical military war, but the West is doing sanctions, which are similar to an announcement of war. So the question is at what moment Russia actually says, wait a second, we are at war. West, quote unquote, has announced a war on us. And we'll start turning to very different responses from their side. So I think that's definitely like a critical tipping point also from their communication. And also what we know from Ukraine, despite the possible talks of negotiations in Ukraine, Russian troops haven't ceased bombing. If anything, they have stepped up the bombing of the cities. So there is no respite on the ground there. Something definitely to watch for as we're looking.
Thank you, Elina. And this comes again from the broader perspective and follow-up of the conflict itself, which we are closely monitoring, as I said before, in this series of live podcasts, and we cannot definitely conclude within our conversation of today about China. But yeah, of course, those kind of things that you are telling us they add an additional layer of, I would say, worriness about what we are living in those days, of course. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. So I would like to thank both of you, Elina and Alicia, for joining us. And I would like to remind that we are going to continue here at Bruegel to cover with our analysis these various aspects of the conflict and especially the economic fallout of the war. And I invite everyone to subscribe to Zhongwa Mundus, our monthly newsletter about global China as seen from Europe. The link is in the show notes. Stay tuned with The Sound of Economics and also check the previous episodes of our overall coverage of the economic consequences of the war as it unfolds on our website www.bruegel.org. And thanks to all of you for tuning in and listening to The Sound of Economics and participating for these special editions, which are live, with all your questions. It's really, really appreciated. Thank you so much, and until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you, bye-bye. Thank you, Lina. Thank you.